Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. My earliest memory of bats was at our family cabin on Little Bitterroot Lake in western Montana. Since my hearing hadn't yet been damaged from going to concerts, I could hear their tiny chirpy sounds after sunset each evening. They had found a wonderful roosting spot behind the frame around the door to the cabin. They could get in there because the cabin was made of logs, and the rounded shape offered just enough of a crevice to allow them to squeeze behind the door frame. My parents knew very little about bats in those days, so rather than leaving them alone, we drove them away and we filled in the spaces so they couldn't come back. And little me learned to be afraid of bats that day. In much more recent memory, I discovered a place in my town where hundreds of bats love to roost in this tiny crack between two buildings. I happened to be walking to my car right after sunset one evening when I could hear high-pitched chirping sounds. And I was really surprised I could even hear it, thanks to the yellow and black spandex-wearing 80s pop metal band Striper and their concerts. I turned around just in time to watch hundreds of flittering bats rush out of their roost to search for dinner. For the 90 seconds or so that it took them all to make their way out, I stood there in utter awe. I had never seen anything like that, and it truly left me speechless. My previous fear had melted away into sheer awe and wonder at what I had just seen. I've learned more about bats throughout my adulthood and have come to deeply appreciate them. For one thing, a little brown bat can eat up to 1,000 mosquitoes per hour. That alone is enough to appreciate them and protect them. Some bats are also important pollinators. Can you imagine a world without tequila? So certainly we must protect bats. When I turned my attention toward dark sky advocacy and combating light pollution several years ago, I learned that light pollution is not a friend to bats. And that's why I'm so happy to introduce to you tonight's guest. I was reading an article a few months ago about bats and light pollution, and the article kept quoting Dr. Tanya Straka. She had so many interesting things to say about the impact of light pollution on bats that I actually chased her down for this podcast. Her enthusiasm about her research made me forget that I was even talking to a scientist as she spoke with awe about her topic. Tanya is an urban ecologist with a focus on bats at the Technische Universität of Berlin. I'm sure I probably have mispronounced that, and I apologize. Her research focuses on light pollution, urban bats, and more generally, how urban areas can be shared between people and wildlife. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Dr. Tanya Straka. Tanya, thank you for joining me on the Night Sky Tours podcast. We're going to talk about a topic that's kind of new for this podcast, but I think it's going to be really fun. We're going to talk about bats.
Thanks for having me today.
So first of all, the reason I got interested in the idea of learning about bats is because I know that light pollution has a big impact on them. And you've been studying bats and light pollution, and I'm really curious. It's such an interesting topic and a combination of topics. I'm interested to know how you got involved in the topic of bats and light pollution.
I was getting interested in bats and light pollution during my PhD. So that's That was the time when I started to work with bats in urban areas. And initially, I was only looking at bats at water sites. But of course, we were also interested what other factors are influencing bats in urban areas. And one of the things we came across is, of course, light pollution. And we also found back then that it has a big impact on some species, not on all species, but some species, especially bats that were foraging close to the water surface in open areas that were most affected by light pollution. So that was kind of the start. But then when I moved back to Germany, I did my postdoc with Christian Vogt, who's an expert in bats and light pollution. And that was the time when I was diving more and more into this topic on this very, fascinating topic.
Okay, so now I'm curious because you say that it's mostly ones who are foraging around water. Is it because of the reflection that they're seeing in the water? Why is it that?
So that was just an example of a bat species that was affected by light pollution. But we say that not all bats are very impacted by light pollution. It's very species specific. So some bat species are more affected than others. So for example, we know that some bat species, like the one that is opening on open water surface, open areas, that they are quite affected. And one of the theories is maybe they are more visible to predators also, like when it's very lit, they forage, and that they are more visible than to other nocturnal birds of prey, for example. But then there are other bat species that forage, for example, around light sources, because light also attracts insects. And then some bat species can just come and feed on these insects around light sources. And so it's very, very species specific. We say depends on kind of their flight patterns, like where they fly, how fast they fly. So it's very, very, species specific.
So what kind of negative effects are you guys seeing with the bats when they encounter the light pollution? What's happening to them?
Most of all, like for example, it's in urban areas, it's fragmenting the landscape. So for example, bats would avoid, like most bat species would avoid lit areas. And then when they forage, for example, in an area where it's dark, they want to forage, they want to move to another area where it's dark. And if in between is light, it's kind of a barrier for them. So it's kind of a barrier in their commuting from A to B, for example. Then it also has a negative impact on roosts. So where bats are roosting, like where when there is a lot of light, we know, for example, that they emerge later from their roost also. That has a negative impact on their foraging success, for example. And so these are just some of the things that we can see that has a negative impact on bats. So and some bat species are just very light sensitive, we would say, that would avoid completely areas where there is light. So it would just exclude them from these areas.
So I live in Arizona, and in the southern part of the state, we have what are called the long-nosed bats. And they're known around these parts for being the major pollinators for the agave plants. And most people know that one of their favorite adult beverages is tequila, which comes from the agave. And so if we carry this out, if the light pollution bothers the long-nosed bats, what's the result for our tequila?
Maybe we don't have tequila anymore. So in fact, it's a very interesting interaction between the bats and the agave plants, because as you said, also they're important pollinators. So we have this very entangled relationship between bats and plants. So when bats come and feed on the nectar, they carry the pollen on their fur to the next plant. So it's kind of this cross-pollination is happening. And bats are so important for this agave plant. So if bats are not there anymore to kind of pollinate those plants, then basically there is no tequila there anymore. And it also relates to some other plants as well. We know it from eucalypts, for example, some wild bananas and so on, like that they really depend on the pollination of bats also.
You know, when I was growing up, I never heard about bats being pollinators. In my head, it was just moths and bees, maybe butterflies, you know. But I've learned, especially being in the desert, how important the bats are for pollination.
Yeah, in some parts of the world, definitely. So in Europe, we don't have pollinating bats. So in Europe, for example, they're insectivorous, like they feed on insects or spiders. And but in some parts of the world, they are important pollinators or seed dispersers. Especially in Latin America, they play this very important role as well. And bats are quite important for our environment, I would say, definitely.
And we kind of live in a culture where, well, I wouldn't say culture, maybe it's worldwide, I would suppose, where there's the stigma about bats. Like people are scared. They think they're these scary creatures that are gonna come get caught in their hair or bite them in the neck or something. And but they play a really vital role. So what would our world look like if we didn't have bats?
Oh, that would be such a sad world, wouldn't it? It would be very sad. And it's interesting, like my dad also told me when I was a kid, like that bats fly in your hair, we have to be careful and everything, and all these myths and stories that we have around bats. And in some cultures, we definitely find these stories still. And also when we look in the Middle Ages, like these stories, like, oh, what creepy creatures, like they hang upside down, they fly through the night, they cannot be kind of, what creatures are they? And increasingly, I sometimes wonder if this is still the case, actually, that bats have such a bad reputation. Maybe I'm a little bit biased, maybe because my circle, like, I'm surrounded also by bat researchers, of course, but I really also wonder if this is still the case, because we have now also places where people really start to appreciate bats. Like when we look, for example, also in Austin, Texas, where we have really the celebration of bats. Lots of tourists come to watch these bats, and then some other parts where maybe it's not kind of this festive, this kind of freely celebration of bat, but maybe there is a tolerance or like an acceptance of living with bats. Sometimes I'm not sure anymore if this is still so much the case, that bats have such a bad reputation. Maybe in some parts of the world, yes, but maybe it's also changing a little bit. Like that's just kind of what I have a little bit the feeling also talking to colleagues. So but yeah, that's it could be also a little bit of a biased view, of course, but I wonder if it's still the case. Yeah.
And you mentioned this thing in Austin. And for people who don't know, Austin has a huge bat population. I think they live under a bridge, right?
Yes, yes.
And people come down to the water as the sun's going
Yes.
down just to watch the bats come out at night.
Yes. It's amazing. It's impressive. I saw it for also for the first time this year in August. It's really impressive. I could really, yeah, it's very, very fascinating to see it.
I used to work in an office building where the building was built probably 3 or 4 inches away from another building. So there was this super, super narrow crack that ran between them. And in the wintertime, when I would come out of the office at 5 o'clock at night, the sun's starting to go down, and you could hear all of this high-pitched noise coming from that crack. And one night I came out a little bit later, just in time for a cloud of bats to rush out of that crack. It
Oh,
was
wow.
astonishing. I just was jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it. It was the most beautiful sight to see them come out.
Amazing. You must have good ears also that you heard them kind of still kind of chatting. So they do that quite often before they start to fly. Like they wake up, kind of they start to chit chat, and then they start flying out. And yeah, I agree, it can be so fascinating to see kind of bats flying out, like a high number of bats. And yeah, I think I forgot to mention before, because we also talked about light and bats. I think I forgot a little bit to mention as well that there are also different levels of light. So bats do not only respond species specific to light, like it's also very different between the light sources. So for example, we have mercury vapor street lamps, of course, we have LED street lamps, and all these different street lamps, and some of them have, for example, UV light, like in the ultraviolet spectrum, and that's very negative for most bat species also. So some bat species can see also UV light, some others not, but this is kind of something that can impact bats a lot. So it also depends on the light sources that we have, how bats respond to kind of light pollution. And then there is also it's also a matter of light color. So we know, for example, also that light with longer wavelengths, such as red light, has a less negative effect on bats, but it comes with the downside that it's not very good for human vision as well, kind of. So it's always kind of a bit of a question also as a trade-off, like what kind of light sources do we have in cities that benefit kind of, or that has not a high impact on bats, for example, or other nocturnal biodiversity. But also kind of how do people feel about around these light sources, like, and do they feel safe? Can they actually see? So it's a little bit a tendency at the moment also to think about how much light do we actually need in cities, and what kind of light sources can we put there, and like, do we need all the time light also in cities, or would it not also be a way to think about having kind of these movement detectors, like that we only use light when we actually need it. So these are kind of the discussions we are also thinking about at the moment. Like, do we always need light also? And
It's interesting that you talk about the different types of lights because the research also shows that different kinds of light impact human health as well. We know that the bright white blue light at night disrupts the human circadian rhythm and, creates sleep problems and a lot of health problems like chronic diseases and things like that. So what we do to help protect the bats when it comes to the lighting that we choose also protects us.
Exactly. And light is not equal light, isn't it? Like, there are ways to use light that has a less negative impact also on nocturnal biodiversity. And yeah, always the question, always if we need all the time light actually at night.
So you've kind of already started touching on this, but what can people do around their own homes? Something they can control themselves. What can they do around their own homes to make it more bat friendly? Because we know if they're making it bat friendly, they're probably also making it moth friendly or, other nocturnal animal friendly and also human friendly. What are some other things that people can do?
So if you would, it depends probably how much space you have and what's available to you, and like what are the resources that you have, and like the spectrum what you could do around your place. But for example, if you would have a garden, there are some plants that attract, for example, some nocturnal insects. Then you could have also like, so nocturnal insects that could be a feeding source for bats, for example. You could have a water source, for example, in your backyard as well. You could protect old trees in your backyard because old trees provide important roots also for bats, like tree hollows or broken branches or bugs or something like that. You could think about bat boxes if you have the space. Avoid light if you don't need it, of course. That probably depends really like on the spectrum that you can do in your own place. And then it's of course always a question as well, like if bats live in your building, like would you be able also to share kind of your, like what do you do if you have kind of bats under your roof and in your building, something like that? Like, would you be able also to share your buildings kind of also with bats?
Oh, that's an interesting thought. I love that. Have you ever read the children's book called Stella Luna?
I heard about this, but I haven't read it yet, but yes, I heard about this.
I've got that book for my kids are in their 20s now, but when they were really little, I bought that book for them and read it to them. And one of the things that I love about it is that I think it helps kids get over their stigma with bats because now all of a sudden you have this sweet story. And my kids were obsessed with Stella Luna, and now I have young nieces. And so I bought the book for them, and now they have the stuffed animal bats, and their wings can like wrap around and Velcro. And they have Velcro on the feet so you can hang them from something upside down. And I just think it's such a great way to introduce kids to bats in a way that makes them
like them.
Yes. And also because they are not so visible, also bats, isn't it? Like to introduce them also to wildlife that might be not something as visible, like as squirrels or birds, for example, because by all means they're still kind of the creatures of the night, like they're still the animals of the night. So it's also something that you might experience maybe at is it dusk, like when the from at dusk, kind of when you still see kind of a little bit of light, like if you have the chance, it's a warm summer night, for example, and you're close to a water place, for example, or you're close to some vegetation patches, and you can, if it's still kind of a little bit of daylight, sometimes you can see them still flying, like you can still see them flying around. So that's maybe a time also when you have the chance to see some bats, or as you mentioned also before, when they fly out of the roost. But then it's also a question like how else can you experience bats, and how we do it also very often in Berlin is like when we go out with citizens and citizen science projects, we do it with bat detectors so that people can get bat detectors and that they can also listen to the bats. And once you start hearing them and you look up, sometimes you can still see them flying. So you also need kind of of course we need this technical devices to also experience bats at night.
I love this idea that you just kind of talked about going out at dusk, because I have bats that I see fly around in my backyard. And so sometimes what I like to do is go sit down and get real comfortable right after the sun has gone down. And then the first time I ever did this, it's because I was doing a little experiment and I wanted to start tracking when I could start seeing different stars appear in the sky. And so I went out earlier than you typically would to do stargazing so I could do that. And that's when I saw the bats just like flittering right over ahead. So it was such a cool experience. And
Oh,
then I
nice.
started doing it just so I could see the bats and then watch the stars come out one by one. And then it made me slow down too, because I had to sit there for a while and wait for all the different stars to come out. But
Yeah.
yeah, it's a great way to combine two different experiences and to really gain an
Yeah.
appreciation for bats.
Yeah, very much so, isn't it? Because it feels like a very, I still like, I'm working now since 2007 with bats, but it still feels like this unique experience where you, when you're there at night and you still see them flying out, it's just still a very, yeah, very fascinating experience.
And it's such an interesting part of the day because you're almost physically feeling this transition between day and night. I really like
Yeah, and you get the company of the bats, as you
it.
explained. Yeah, totally.
Tanya, where can people learn more about the work that you're doing if they're really interested into digging into this more?
Yeah, sure. So I have a website which is tanjastraka.com, and I have always news. There are publications that we do. Yep, so that would be maybe a place if people wanna find out more about us.
All right, I'll put that link in the show notes so people can go and just click right on it and get over there.
Great.
Tanya, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing such an interesting topic with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's 2023, and I'm excited to share with you another year of falling in love with the dark and discovering more about the night sky. This year, I'm working on a book about night sky experiences on Highway 89, the original highway stretch from Nogales, Arizona, at the border of Mexico, up through Utah, Wyoming, and it ended at the border of Canada, just east of Glacier National Park in Montana. This book will take you along Highway 89 to introduce you to observatories, planetariums, and some of the best places to see the night sky in the entire country. You'll discover ancient archaeoastronomy sites along the way and find out about thrilling night sky events throughout the year. We'll even meet the indigenous people who live along this corridor and learn about their cultural relationship with the night sky and even hear their traditional star stories. You can stay up to date on this project, get some behind the scenes info, and even have opportunities to share your own stories or give feedback. I'm only sharing this behind-the-scenes journey with my subscribers. So sign up today for my newsletter to take this journey with me. All you have to do is visit nightskytourist.com and subscribe today. And when you subscribe, you'll get my stargazing guide called Things to See in the Night Sky in 2023. It's free, and you'll never miss a meteor shower, eclipse, or an opportunity to see a planet or amazing constellations. This guide is only available to subscribers of my newsletter, so sign up today at nightskytourist.com. That's nightskytourist.com. It's time for our tour across the night sky for January 2023. Pause the podcast, gather everyone in your home, turn off the outside lights, and I'll meet you outside under the stars. We have this special treat of seeing four planets at once throughout the month, and all of them are easily visible with the naked eye. Saturn is getting ready to leave the evening sky soon, but you can still spot it in the southwestern sky when it gets dark. If you have access to a telescope, make sure you take a good look at this beauty. It is one of the most spectacular things to look at with a decent backyard telescope. Even binoculars will give you a great view of its rings. Venus is also in the vicinity of Saturn toward the southwestern sky, and you can't miss it because it's so bright. As the weeks go by, Venus is going to appear higher and higher above the western horizon until it reaches its highest point, and then it's going to reverse and it will appear lower and lower on the horizon until it eventually disappears, only to reappear in the eastern sky before sunrise. This is my favorite naked eye planet, and I love the stories associated with it. You can learn more about humanity's relationship with this planet in my blog article that's titled Venus, the Planet with Two Names. Look for a link to it in the show notes, or you can visit nightskytourist.com/56. Higher overhead is the bright planet Jupiter, and this is another one that you'll want to try to see with a telescope. A good backyard telescope will reveal its colored storm bands and the four Galilean moons. They're called that because Galileo was the one who realized that they were moons. And when he came to that realization, he thought, so if there's objects orbiting another planet, then Earth can't be the center of the universe. And so this idea of Earth being the center of everything that existed began to erode right in that moment. And finally, we can also see the planet Mars. It's up fairly high and slightly to the southeast. It's a bright star with a reddish hue. And every time I look at Mars, I can't help but think about all the research that humans are doing there right now. It's pretty astounding to me. Let's take a fun little hop across the night sky. We're going to start looking toward the eastern horizon. Now, if you're in a really dark location, you can probably spot Cancer, the crab. But if you have some light pollution like I do, the stars are probably too dim to be able to spot it. Moving your eyes a bit more westward is the famous constellation called Gemini, the twins. I always start by locating the twin stars of Castor and Pollux, and then I look for the rest of the constellation from there. Now, looking toward the southwest from there is one of the most famous of all constellations, after the Big Dipper, of course. And this one is the great hunter Orion. Most people find Orion by looking for the three stars in a row that make up his belt. You can also spot the reddish-colored star that's in his shoulder, and it's called Betelgeuse. I love this constellation because it's really easy to find in the winter night sky, but also because of the variety of cultural stories from around the world that are associated with it. Okay, from Orion, shift your eyes to the southeast of it to find that super bright white star. That's called Sirius. And it's the brightest star in the night sky. And Venus can appear brighter, and sometimes Jupiter does too, but those are both planets. Sirius is the brightest star, and it's part of the constellation called Canis Major, or the Big Dog. Okay, go back up to Orion, and then shift your eyes westward to find Taurus, the bull. Taurus looks like a big sideways V. You'll probably have an easier time finding the smaller V that just makes up the face of the bull. Can you see his angry red eye? That star is called Aldebaran. And Taurus's face is an asterism that's called Hyades. Now, wait a second. What's an asterism? So an asterism is just a grouping of stars that has a name, but it's smaller than a constellation. And a lot of times they're part of a bigger constellation. So in the case of Taurus, there are two asterisms. One is the Hyades, that small V that makes up the face of the bull, and the other is to the east of it. It's a tight little grouping of bright stars. People who have decent enough eyesight sometimes mistake it as the Little Dipper. This is actually called the Pleiades, and it is one of my favorite star groupings in the night sky. Can you spot it? Now, before we leave Taurus, let's go back to its face. If you extend each side of that V, you will spot the tips of its horns. Now, don't worry if you can't figure it out. Use your stargazing app. This is a really fun constellation to explore with a stargazing app. Now, looking westward from Taurus is the small constellation called Aries. It can be tough to find because it only has a few stars, but it does have one bright star that'll help you to locate it. And use your stargazing app if you need to. West from Aries is Pisces. I have rarely been able to see this one. Although it's large, the stars are really dim and they're hard to find in light-polluted skies. Toward the northwestern sky are four somewhat bright stars that make a big box. And this is known as the Great Square of Pegasus. Pegasus is known in Greek and Roman mythologies as a winged horse. And again, your stargazing app will help you find all of its stars. The cool thing is that the Andromeda Galaxy is located within the Pegasus constellation. Andromeda is our nearest galactic neighbor, and we're on a collision course with one another. It's about 2.5 million light years away. Although Andromeda is visible to the naked eye, you do have to be in an exceptionally dark location to be able to see it. I've seen it only a couple of times, and it blows my mind that light from another galaxy left that place 2.5 million years ago and is only now reaching my eye. What was happening on Earth 2.5 million years ago when that light started its journey here? 2.5 million years ago, we were in the Paleolithic period, which was also known as the Old Stone Age. And during that time, hominids were grouping together in small societies. They were gathering plants and fishing and hunting. They were using napped stone tools, but were also using wood and bone tools still. They were even using leather and vegetable fibers. Do you know what else they were doing? Looking up at the stars every single night. Without a single artificial light to blot out their view. Can you even imagine what the sky must have looked like? Maybe they saw Andromeda too, and they were seeing light that had left that galaxy 2.5 million years earlier. Whoa, hold on a second. That's where it starts to get a little bit trippy for me. Stay tuned for our star stories about the Pleiades in our next episode. Until then, be sure to check out the show notes for links to things mentioned in this episode, or visit nightskytourist.com/56. Don't forget to subscribe for the newsletter while you're on the website, where you'll get exclusive content, including some fun behind-the-scenes stuff from my upcoming book. That's nightskytourist.com/56. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tours podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.